Ladies and gentlemen, sorry to interrupt your lunch, but if I could call the meeting to order, and please feel free to, well, in good CSIS fashion, it's okay to nosh on as we're starting this discussion. But first of all, my name is Stephen Flanagan. I'm Senior Vice President at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and it's a pleasure to welcome you all here this afternoon, and to also welcome back to Washington and to CSIS a man who's worn many hats. He's been a freedom fighter, a statesman, a tradesman, an art activist, and a rock promoter, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a moment, as any good Czech leader should have some history in rock and roll, but he's also both a good personal friend and a great friend of the United States. This is the 8th annual Czech and Slovak Freedom Lecture, and Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Vondra has kindly agreed to join us for this. It's a lecture, as I'm sure many of you in the audience know, is organized in cooperation with the American Friends of the Czech Republic and the Friends of Slovakia. And indeed, there will be an award from the Friends of Slovakia at the end of this for Deputy Minister Vondra. As you know, he is currently serving since January of this year, Deputy Minister Vondra, as Deputy Prime Minister for European Affairs. He has, of course, had a long and very impressive diplomatic career, but I want to take you back a little bit further in his history, the history that led up to, of course, the Velvet Revolution. Born in Prague, Sasha Vondra graduated from Charles University in the very non-political subject of geography in the Department of Natural Sciences, and he later earned his doctorate also in natural sciences. But, of course, during the 80s, he participated in the activities of the Democratic opposition, focusing on editorial publishing in Samizdat and cooperating with other opposition groups in Central and Eastern Europe. And in that context, he also became the manager of the rock band Narodi Triada. I don't know, some of you may have seen last weekend the New York Times had a story about the plastic people of the universe, and I want to tell just a little personal story about Ambassador Vondra. Then when he was here in the United States, he going back to that period when he was ambassador, he approached me when we had the state visit of President Havel in 1999 and asked, he said, well, you know, President Havel is very fond of rock and roll, and particularly the group, the Plastic People of the Universe, who were inspired by Lou Reed. And so for the entertainment, the president would like to perhaps have Lou Reed as the musical entertainment. And so you can imagine the shock that came over the face of the White House social secretary when I approached them and suggested that we were going to invite Lou Reed to be the entertainment at the state dinner. But it all worked out very well, and Lou Reed was on great behavior, and President Havel was delighted to have. We couldn't book the Plastic People of the Universe, but I am delighted to see that they are giving revival concerts again. But anyway, just a little diversion. But Ambassador Vondra, of course, was a signer of Charter 77, worked in the fields outside his profession as a result of that, first as a boiler man and later as a computer programmer. In 1989, he became a spokesperson for Charter 77, and in retaliation for his organization of demonstrations and of the petition, a few sentences, he was then sentenced to 2 months in prison. And during the Velvet Revolution, of course, he became the co-founder and leading member of the Civic Forum movement. Now for his more straightforward diplomatic career later, of course, as you know, he first served as a foreign policy advisor to President Havel in the early 90s, and then as First Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs, where he was instrumental in both the Czech Republic's, first of all, the Czech and Slovak velvet divorce in the elements of the rapprochement with Germany, and of course, quite triumphantly, in its further integration into both NATO and the EU. And following this, he was, as I mentioned, of course, and many of you know well, he served as ambassador with great distinction here in Washington from 1997 to 2001, where he was able to, in fact, preside over the Czech Republic's accession and integration into NATO. And then later on, of course, helped organize and plan the very successful NATO Prague summit in 2002. Today, though, he's going to talk to us more about his current preoccupation, the very challenging agenda of managing the Czech Republic's involvement in European affairs. But anyway, we're delighted to welcome back Sasha Vondra to CSIS and to Washington. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Steve. Thanks all of you coming here today. You mentioned this story about the visit of President Havel in the White House. And, you know, it reminded me how we had really great times here and funny times here when we were working with Steve as well as Dan Fried and others, you know, the U.S. founding fathers of the first wave of the NATO enlargement. And it always will remain in my memory, you know, this gentle style and responsiveness of the people like Steve. And it was not easy, you know, this story, you know, it's not full. It was not in 1999, it was in fact in 1998. It was September 1998. And those of you who remember, it was an uneasy time for your administration. It was also a difficult time for us because Václav Havel was coming just from the hospital after a major operation. And this request to have Lou Reed as a part of the show after a dinner show in the White House official state dinner, you know, you were really mobilizing a lot of courage because I remember that, you know, September 98, the first public appearances of your presidents after the January 98, there were the fears that, you know, the headlines in the newspapers could find an inspiration from this famous song by Lou Reed, "Take a Walk on the World Side." And despite all that, your response was positive. So thank you very much for your courage and engagement. It's also great to be here and to speak at this, now it's called the CSIS Freedom Lecture, so thank you very much to CSIS for adopting this, because I remember when we founded this, I think it's already 8 years ago, with my friend Martin Butora, who was the ambassador here, and we want to commemorate first the anniversary of the November 17 Velvet Revolution. And in a situation that there are already two states, Czech Republic and Slovakia, while the Velvet Revolution was a joint venture done by the Czechs and Slovaks, both in Prague and Bratislava. So to commemorate this somehow in the joint way, and I'm very glad that this tradition or this plan survived and was not burned as many other initiative. So thank you very much to CSIS for adopting the child which we offered with Martin some time ago. The topic of my today statement is the EU and the US of the 21st century or what identity for the transatlantic relationship now. You know, we all remember that 3, 4, 5 years ago, 2003 around, you could read dramatic titles all over European and American newspapers. The headlines like, "Is the Transatlantic Alliance over or dead?" or "Chirac, to the EU newcomers, you missed an opportunity to shut up." You remember, or anti-American protests in Germany, etc., etc. Last week, we ran in our office through international press, and guess what we read? Example, "France has been welcomed with warmth, love, and friendship," says Sarkozy in the White House. Or, "It is the kind of man I like to deal with," is quoting George Bush on Sarkozy. Or, "Ambitious bid to end dispute," says the Financial Times article referring to the first meeting of the Transatlantic Economic Council here in Washington, the joint project which was elaborated by Angela Merkel and your president. So what is different? What has so dramatically changed in the transatlantic relationship? Would I dare to say, actually, not that much. Unlike many others, I kept insisting, even in times when the crisis between the US and EU was reaching its peak, that values and strategic interests at the two shores of Atlantic Ocean remain convergent. We form today, as we did 3 years or 20 years ago, a community of values. We share a commitment to democracy, universal values codified by law, freedom of thought and speech, superiority of individual above the state, market economy, etc., etc. What is true for values is also true for our strategic interests, international terrorism, energy security, or human rights deficit in the third world are equally alarming on both sides of Atlantic Ocean. Temporary disagreements on particularities like the chicken meat or personal antipathies cannot change that. But still, something is different compared to the Cold War times. In contrast to the days when Soviet missiles were aiming at Western Europe, today the Transatlantic Alliance has become an alliance of choice. Europeans are free to choose whether to join or not the US endeavors to spread democracy and market economy. This choice is all the more difficult that the enemy is not as easily identifiable as before. Too many Europeans, our mission is not so clear and ambiguous in the absence of the Iron Curtain. That is one of the main reasons why many Europeans have had some troubles responding to the voluntarism and idealism of the US foreign policy, which Pierre Hassner called the Wilsonianism in Boots. The only exception were those EU members who owe their statehood to the Wilsonian idealism of the World War I and are still quite responsive to its moral message. And Czech Republic and Slovakia, or former Czechoslovakia, as a product of that endeavor, belongs by, is no doubt, to these countries. Apart from the European complex of the post-Cold War orphan, additional factors contributed to blurring the prospect of the transatlantic relationship at the beginning of the new millennium. EU is going through a sort of adolescence. European integration project has been a clear success. It enlarged the area of stability and prosperity to already 27 European states and created an unprecedented form of the European cooperation. But as Europe shares more and more sovereignty in more and more areas, it also faces difficulties in meeting the challenges of newly defining its own identity and projecting the democracy from within. So the so-called constitutional process of the EU was an unsuccessful attempt to address this issue, and we just believe that the current reform treaty, which is to be signed in the middle of December this year in Lisbon, is less ambitious, but hopefully more reasonable compromise. Still, we do oppose another expressions of the European emancipation, like the attempts to self-define Europe as a non-US or even as a competitor to the US. So why are US, from our perspective, so important to Europe or to the European Union? I must admit that I'm sometimes a little frustrated when explaining back in Europe what seems so obvious to us in Prague. First, United States saved Europe twice from the total destruction at the price of huge human and financial sacrifices. And we will always remember this liberation role, either in 1918 or 1945. Secondly, without the Marshall Plan, the recovery of Europe from the World War II and the subsequent economic miracle of Western Europe would not have been thinkable without the strong American support for the European project. We always remember the role of the people like Harry Truman, Dean Acheson, and their role as the real founding father of the modern European integration. This help provided with certain conditionality in the mutual cooperation in Europe, and done in a gentle way, submitting secretly to Europe and giving the Europeans chance to raise this as their own initiative, not as the U.S. initiative, although it was the U.S. Initiative or U.S. ideas. And a third, without the victory in the Cold War, to which the United States, and the United States of both so different figures like Jimmy Carter and its policy of the human rights on one hand, and Ronald Reagan and its policy of the strong armaments on the other hand, that those U.S. has greatly contributed, and countries of Central and Eastern Europe would not have been liberated, or the members of NATO or the EU today without that leading U.S. role. So without the American determination to preserve NATO after the fall of the Iron Curtain, the Central European would not have today this unprecedented security guarantee. The U.S. leadership was instrumental, and thus we believe that the U.S. active engagement and active role must continue. There is still a lot of inspiration the U.S. can provide for us in Europe. To mention just a few examples, for example, the entrepreneurial or competitive spirit that sees the globalization as a challenge and not as a threat. You know, we in Europe, we had this grand Lisbon strategy to raise the competitiveness. Everybody is using the same kind of language. But if you are listening carefully, you can recognize the two ways of doing the things. One is this Anglo-Saxonian, so it's more business-like, more competitive. And the other one is, look, this Mediterranean way of doing the things. It's great, you know, good wine, good food. It's much better than here. But once you are approaching the problems, you need the Anglo-Saxonian spirit and courage. Or the already mentioned values in the politics, which is the fight against the political apathy and are a motor of reform and clearly clear policy choices. Which areas will be of crucial strategic importance to the transatlantic relationship of the 21st century? We believe that the three are the key. A, security, B, economic cooperation, and the third, on energy. On security, two issues, I think, should be mentioned specifically. The first one, EU and the US should engage in a serious debate on the future of NATO. Shall it become global or remain European North Atlanticist? Or, what is now also the buzz, shall France get back into the military structure? The general answer to those questions is yes. But, you know, until the end of the Cold War, NATO was meant to protect Europe, North American area against the Soviet Union, and the choices were relatively easy. The implicit objective was to achieve the reunification and to guarantee the security of the European continent. From this point of view, the NATO enlargement, the NATO interventions in former Yugoslavia in the 90s, represented the fulfillment of aims of the original Washington Treaty. On the contrary, the 9/11, invoking the Article 5 of the treaty and the intervention in Afghanistan, have been a real novelty. In the aftermath, we have to ask the following question: should we enlarge NATO further and accept non-European members so as to enable NATO to reach sufficient numbers of soldiers for their operation? And it's the real challenge. You know, we will be meeting in Bucharest and would be controlling where we are with the so-called famous Prague commitments from the summit of 2002, and the balance is the mixed at best. Or to gain operational basis closer to the threats, to the theaters of the intervention, and thus become really global? Those are the serious questions. I personally believe that NATO now should firstly reinforce the military capacity of its member states, especially the Europeans, who are lagging behind still the technological capacity and the efficiency of the U.S. armed forces. Here I would like to mention that a revision of certain principles of American industrial policy, which would enable to create a genuine transatlantic market in armament, would be extremely helpful in our catching up and would enable us to assume more quickly our part of responsibility for the world security. Also, any ambition to act globally is bound to fail if Europe does not make more progress on coordinating its position and does not overcome fundamental divergences that prevail in the security and defense area. And the upcoming debate on Kosovo, we were discussing this, waiting for the lunch with Steve, I think would show us where we in Europe really are right now, because, you know, this dream about having a united stand on Kosovo among all 27 EU members would not be able to fulfill. In this respect, the ESDP should be even more intertwined with NATO, boosting its crisis management capacities and providing for Europe to share more equally the burden of ensuring its security. Secondly, there is a major security issue of transatlantic relations that needs to be mentioned too, the missile defense and the European pillar in particular, because the Czech Republic together with Poland are engaged right now in the serious talks with the U.S. Administration on deploying certain equipments, radar as well as the interceptors on the soil of Central Europe. There has been a heated debate on this topic in Europe throughout the last months. Let me explain why we consider our cooperation with the U.S. on missile defense as the crucial one. The first American president, George Washington, said, "To be ready for the war is the most effective way to preserve the peace." Today, there is the agreement among NATO nations that the ballistic missile threat exists and is increasing. Diplomacy, non-proliferation, and arms control agreements, as well as deterrence, all have an important role to play in our response to the spread of ballistic missile technology. But it is clear that these measures have not succeeded in important cases. Iran's ongoing nuclear program suggests that, as well as increasingly ambitious tests of Iran's missile programs, suggest that this regime is determined to acquire these capabilities, even facing significant international opposition, and is willing to endure diplomatic criticism, sanctions, and material hardship to do so. There is an additional aspect to this. although missile defense is in the interest of Europe as a whole, countries of Central and Eastern Europe are particularly motivated to contribute to its creation. History has taught us a bitter security lesson, and keeping U.S. engaged in European territory will always be an overriding priority for those countries once behind the Iron Curtain. The growing ambition of Russia not only to return among superpowers, but also to regain the influence in the Central European area, which it considers to be its backyard, provides additional impetus to this action. Missile defense is by no means directed against Russia, nor it is intending to threaten its security. But it does further consolidate the transatlantic bond and thus provide Central European countries with a guarantee that the current geopolitical setting is going to persist. Last but not least, it is absolutely indispensable that all allies in NATO within the North Atlantic area enjoy the same level of security. U.S. will have a shield and does have already. So Europe won't unless we cooperate. We all need to benefit from the same protection of the anti-missile umbrella. And yesterday I was trying to explain this, you know, it was a rainy day in Washington, and if there are two allies, two friends, you know, walking on the street, so one has the umbrella and the other has not, so they are in the entirely different situation. So we should really work together to have the umbrella above us. The contrary would mean to abandon the basic principle of the post-World War II Euro-Atlantic security relationship. I will try to be brief on the two following topics, so economy and energy. On transatlantic economic relationship, EU and the US dominate the global economy. According to the study of Deutsche Bank, EU is the biggest integrated economy area in the world with a population of almost 500 million in 27 member states and a domestic product of in euro consists of 11 trillion. The US follows with almost 300 million people and a domestic product equivalent in euro reach the 10 million. So together we generate almost 60% of the world economic output and around 40% of the world trade, with exchanges worth of almost 2 billion euro in a day. But this will not last forever. Brazil, India, or China in particular, are becoming significant actors on international level. We need to act jointly to ensure that in the future, European and American companies will be guaranteed a level playing field, market access, reinforced intellectual property in position in the economic relations. We also need to ensure that we will maintain a solid position among the leaders of the world economy. That is a strong incentive both for the EU and the US to bolster mutual economic cooperation to remove a significant amount of material, procedural, and regulatory barriers in transatlantic trade, as well as to deal jointly with emerging economic superpowers. The Transatlantic Economic Partnership, an initiative revived by the German Chancellor Angela Merkel and President Bush, is clearly a way to address these issues. The progress has been reached on certain issues such as mutual recognition of accounting standards or common technical standards for biofuels. It would be beneficial for both citizens of the EU and the US, as well as for our companies, if we manage not to lose momentum here and make a genuine transatlantic economic partnership a reality. US and the EU also shares common responsibility for the success of the relaunch Doha round within the WTO. on the international trade liberalization talks. It was the EU-US disputes that caused the breakdown of the negotiation in last year. And in July of this year, a new set of compromises has been proposed asking concessions from the both sides. We cannot afford to be the cause of failure once again. Too much is at stake. The prosperity of developing country and our credibility as pioneers of liberalism in the first place. On energy, the global competition for energy resources is definitely increasing. Access to energy resources will be soon determining our respective positions on the world's geopolitical chessboard. This is all the more alarming that most of the resources are situated in countries with unstable or authoritarian regimes. In this context, a concerted action of the EU and the US would be more than convenient. In a globalizing world, we need global alliances. As Zino Baran stated in her study for the European Parliament, today both EU and US are more willing to engage in a dialogue on ensuring mutual energy security. It is in our common interest to jointly devise strategies that will enable us to either prevent the creation of or cope with monopolies controlling the supply of energy. This particular issue is of major importance for the countries of Central and Eastern Europe. As you go east, the dependency on Russia and vulnerability to its potential political pressure increases. While Germany imports just 42% of its gas from Russia, the Czechs do 70%, Hungary 80%, Slovakia 98%, the Baltic states are entirely dependent on gas import from Gazprom. That is just one of many reasons why energy security, including the transatlantic dimension, ranks very high on the list of our priorities, I mean the Czech Republic, for our presidency within the EU in 2009. So let me conclude my remarks here. Since the end of the Cold War, Europe and the US have been searching for a new definition of its relationship. The fall of the bipolar world has set off a new American dynamism and boosted the awareness of the unique military as well as economic superiority of the US. This has sometimes led to controversies between Europe and the US, for example, on principles of international law to be used in the international relations, protection of personal data, or as well as to the occasional flaring up of American-European trade, monetary, or financial conflicts. These disagreements, however, should be viewed more as labor pains of a new post-Cold War transatlantic relationship rather than its death toll. History and relationship are shaped by people as much by events. In Europe, we are now entering a phase of political conjuncture of new Atlanticism, hopefully with, on one hand, Germany of Angela Merkel, resuming its traditional role of backbone of the Euro-Atlantic relationship, and with France of Nicolas Sarkozy, on the other hand, who is probably the most pro-Atlanticist French president ever. Last but not least, with Central and Eastern European countries who have always been keen on a strong Euro-Atlantic bond. It's far from being certain, but we have a chance now, and it would be great to exploit it. So for our future, it is crucial that Europe sends itself as a part of the transatlantic synthesis, not as a competitor or alternative center of power, rather as an equal partner. Despite occasionally disagreements, we have to keep the big picture in mind. Not a single problem in the world can be fixed or solved if Europe and the United States are at odds. We should always keep in mind our overriding common interest and collective responsibilities. The transatlantic partnership is a key factor for stability and security throughout the world. Therefore, we should do our best to keep this bond vital and strong. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Ambassador Vondra, Deputy Minister Vondra, I should say. I was tempted to just say amen to that last tagline that you had, but thank you for really a very sweeping presentation and truly a reminder of how the transatlantic agenda is really a global agenda today and what responsibilities the United States and Europe have in promoting prosperity and security around the world, and indeed, I think, and I hope, certainly continue to promote democracy, if perhaps in a less forceful way than we have of late. But in any event, let's open the floor for discussion. We have a little over about half an hour. As I mentioned, the Friends of Slovakia would like to make a brief presentation at the end of the room. I think we have. Do we have some microphones in the back or not? No, we do, yes. Okay. If you could just raise your hand, I'll recognize you, and then please identify yourself for those of you I don't recognize. Yes, sir. Could you just wait for the microphone, just maybe identify?
Thank you. Mr. Deputy Prime Minister, first of all, welcome aboard. Let me be the one to break the ice almost literally here. Lately, your president, Václav Klaus, has been saying that this international global climate change and global warming is not all it's cracked up to be. In fact, he put that in pretty strong language. And this puts him at odds with some of Europe's leaders, not to mention with some rather illustrious personages here. I wonder if you could address this question a little bit, and what is your own take on this? By the way, I'm Julian Josephson with Bootstrap Press here local.
Well, I did not have a single word on the climate change in my presentation here because I did not want to provoke. That's my first comment. Second comment is, as Steve has said, I studied geography. So I studied climatology, contrary to Lord Stern, who did not. So I know something about the global warming, about those theories, which were already here in the middle of 80s, but did not attract so much attention because it was not exploited for the political purposes or for the business advantages. Third, yes, we have the problem in energy raising demands. It's a development which is pushed by the rise of China, India, and the growing demand. So if you have the oil prices like $100 per barrel, I remember when I was here, 2000, it was how much, $16? I think your gasoline, the cost it how much, 80 cents, now it's more than $3. So, there are the reasons why can easily justify it where we are now in the debate on the climate change and how much it has changed since the mid of 80s or mid of 90s. So here, Klaus is always provoking. He likes to provoke. I am the member of the government and we should be able to find a compromise, it's not to lead a country into the wars. But I have to tell you that in certain skepticism, I'm here with Klaus. Sometimes, if you see those developments, the public realize, with the posters in the streets of London or even New York, we want decarbonized society. So we, coming from Prague, having an experience with this Labor Day realize, you know, we want society without the class. So we are a bit skeptical here, you know, if we are confronted with the atmosphere like this. It doesn't mean that there is not a global warming. There is. It should be carefully studied what the role is, the human being role, and what is the effect of other influences like the changes in the rotation of Earth, rotation of Earth around the sun, and you know, the changes on the effect of sun radiation. Right now, we are clearly in the situation that those who product the study showing the global warming as an impact of the human being, they are receiving more grants than the others. It's nothing new. My mother was a geologist and planetologist, and she had the similar experiences in the 80s. You know, there were two theories, you know, how the craters in the moon and in the planets were created. But, you know, they were created either by impacts of the meteorites or by the volcanic activity. And as nothing is black and white, you know. But the question is, where is the mainstream? And she was always very critical how the impact theory, you know, arguing that more craters were created by the impacts than by the volcanic activities, that those scientists who were supporting this activity were at a huge advantage because they were supported by the militaries, both in the U.S. and in the Soviet Union, because, you know, the bombing is testing, while the volcanic activity, you know, its military has no role in that. So I'm afraid that we are in a bit similar situation right now and share certain skepticism, understand, you know, why there is so much energy spent by Klaus to oppose that and somehow to balance debate. So it does not mean that I agree with everything what Klaus has said on that. You know, it's a reactionary, you know, he's reacting to certain tendency, and you need to find a certain equilibrium, and you have to provoke strongly to achieve a little bit balance in the debate. So this is, you know, if you ask me about my personal view, I share certain skepticism against the trend, which is too much about the fashion, which is too much about the business interest of certain groups. But it does not mean that we would have to refuse everything on this. You know, we should develop the renewable sources of the energy. It's our security interest. We should do our best to save the energy, because, you know, it's at the end of it's to our advantage. And certainly, you know, with my experience living here, the U.S. Have a huge deficit in finding some, you know, measures how to save the energy and not to spend so much, beginning by cars and ending with the various buildings. And here Europe is definitely more advanced. It's a must for Europe because we are depending on energy and its import much more than you do. So some measures taken as a product of this development are the measures to our advantage, and we should exploit them and not to say no to them or to be negative. And that's my other part of the response.
Mr. Vonder, could I draw you out a little bit on that question about energy and how it relates to the transatlantic debate on dealing with Russia and the reassertive energy superpower that we now confront? Do you see, as you meet in European councils,
a growing cleavage in the way some Europeans are looking at how to handle Russia in this context of its new reassertiveness, not only in the missile defense issue, but also because of energy dependencies that some allies, without necessarily naming names, but that there is a growing cleavage, once again, on how to handle Russia and how you think we should best manage that, as many, certainly many of the Baltic countries, we're going to have, in fact, later this month, the Defense Minister of Estonia coming to talk a little bit about the cyber attack. Obviously, a great deal of fear and uncertainty about Russia's longer-term intentions now in parts of your immediate neighborhood. But yet some West and some West Europeans being quite quite alarmed as well about some of Russia's behavior, but yet others are being a little bit more cautious. And I wonder how you see that playing out in both the inter-European debate and the transatlantic debate.
Well, I believe that in the past, let's say, 1 or 2 years, there are some signs that Europe takes this more seriously. You know, what you could do in responding to this challenge of, you know, the growing dependence on Russia. So the means are the following. So first, you can diversify the imports of the traditional resources like oil and gas. And here, I think we can be now more positive with the growing European willingness to fix the alternative or diversified routes of gas and oil into Europe from other regions. One obvious example is the Caspian region. You know, it was pushed by the U.S. for many years without any serious European response. But right now, you know, in the projects, we have already the European stakeholders, both in the state as well as in the private sector, in the projects like Nabucco, which is supposed to bring the gas into Europe from Caspian region. So that's the one example of the geographical diversification. Then second mean is somehow to diversify more the energy mix in the European states. And here I also believe that we would be led into more rational stand than Europe was taken in the past year. So in the past year, it was influenced by simply the fact that there was a growing appetite to depend on gas because of the environmental problems. So, you know, the fact is that gas is better for, if you compare the environmental impact, it's better to use gas than the coal, for example. But because, you know, after the Chernobyl disaster in the Ukraine, there was growing opposition against the use of the nuclear energy. And I hope that this is now changing. Still, you know, and we as a Czech, because we have our nuclear power plants and we did not give up, although right now we are in the coalition with the Green Party and it's a bit problem for our coalition, but it's a temporary, let's say, bump on the road for us because 70% of the Czechs supports the use of nuclear energy and all major parties are in favor of constructing even more. So. But we have our own problem with Austria and Germany because they made those negative decisions in the past. So, but the atmosphere in Europe is slowly changing. Finland has a great program of exploiting the nuclear energy in a modernized power stations. So I think that this is the second way what Europe can do, to diversify mix, to return back also to more exploitation of the nuclear energy. And then the third factor, it's the continuing debate on the liberalization of the energy market in Europe. Just the European Commission proposed what is called the third energetic package, which brought some proposals for further liberalization, including the so-called unbundling, so divide the distribution of the electricity on the electricity and the gas market from the roots. But as always, you know, We are facing a difficult choices, and Europe must be ready for those reforms. If those reforms are done without any, let's say, any security breaks or control mechanism, it can easily result in an opposite situation from what was intended to achieve. So here we have the similar debates like you did, discussing, you know, China purchasing your ports, or I think you had also your own oil disputes regarding Chinese. So there has to be a lot of work ahead of us to have some, to adopt some legislative measures which would guarantee that this liberalization would not lead to the situation that Gazprom's or the Chinese state funds would buy everything in Europe. But I believe that we are able to do so.
Yes, sir. And Ambassador Russell, two questions. Why don't we take two questions together, and then you can respond, perhaps. This gentleman here, and then...
You mentioned in connection with the issue of missile defense that you didn't see how the emplacement of a radar, possible emplacement of radar in the Czech Republic and of interceptors in Poland, how that would really threaten Russian interests that much, and certainly that's been the U.S. position as I understand it. To what do you attribute the very, very strong Russian reaction to the notion of such a limited missile defense?
Well, there are, I think, the more reasons. Let's divide it according to the meaning. So let's admit even that there can be some justifiable fears that the radar and the beam can observe something over the Russian territory. I think that those arguments or fears could be fixed. We have enough experiences with creating certain confidence, building measures. Even, you know, they had their fears regarding the NATO enlargement, and they were fixed. We created the NATO-Russia Council. We created the mechanism for dialogue. Or early in the 90s, we created these open eye schemes where, you know, both Russians and the Americans or whoever can make their control from the space. So certainly I can easily imagine the various measures to adopt there to assure the Russians that this is really not directed against them, and have no doubts that it's technically feasible as well as diplomatically feasible. On the other hand, you know, I believe that, you know, this negative Russian rhetoric is simply the expression of their larger or bigger assertivity in handling the things, and simply they do not want to give up their influence in the countries around. And, you know, this is about placing the U.S., not just the U.S. soldiers, but the strategic components in the middle of Europe. So that's one argument why we like it. And it's logically the argument why the Russians do not like it. And more, you know, the stronger Russian rhetorics, more our appetite to do that and to accept this. And look, I think Putin differs from Yeltsin that he simply is professional, experienced guy. Sometimes, you know, both the Americans and Europeans should be more, you know, prepared for those games. We are, you know, our experience is past 15 years and was heyday times, you know, it was easy to handle with the Russians of Yeltsin or Primakov. But this is a KGB-educated guy. They know how to play the games. They know how to develop a certain strategy and to lead this in a way that Russia would be benefit most at the end. So, you know, just we should be ready. We should be strong enough not to be the loser at the end of the road. And look, you can find some examples how the situation has changed. For example, in Moldova, you know, there's a traditional problem, this problem of the frozen conflict in Transnistria. I don't know whether you followed it closely. After many years of, you know, Western passivity and inability to fix the problem, the U.S. were bringing a skilled, smart diplomat who were doing a great job there in as the envoy for OSCE. I think was some businessman by origin from the Wall Street named O'Neill. You know the story. And, you know, the Russians did not like him. So they were searching, you know, observing his activities for 2 years from every angle, finding the weak points. So as a rich man from the Wall Street, you know, he was collecting some post-revolutionary posters in Russia. And then, you know, after 2 years observation, they made the search in his luggage when he was traveling there, find some posters, and accused him of, you know, taking the treasury of, you know, their art out, and it was not the treasury of art, so, but, outside of Russia. So it's finished. So, you know, just where we are, it's a new environment now. It's not the same type of environment which we remember in the past 15 years. I could mention another example with Toshovsky and the Russian attempt to nominate him for IMF. Yeah, to destabilize the fragile consensus in the EU, to find some credits among the, you know, other countries like China, Brazil. They're smart.
Okay, let me, just in the interest of time, let me just take two questions. There's one here and one over there, and then we'll let you respond, and then we'll go to the presentation. Thank you.
Sasha, my question follows up on Ambassador Russell's. We have some major media organizations that still have their mentality in the Cold War, namely the Washington Post and National Public Radio, still keep referring to a U.S. missile defense system located in some place they refer to as Eastern Europe. And I keep writing to them saying that they've got their geography wrong. But I noted that Putin referred to the Czech Republic and Poland as Eastern Europe. And just to follow up on your response, I know these areas, I don't think in the Russian mentality are what is traditionally known as the Blisko Zagranitsa, but do you think that the Russians still somehow in their mind have the Czech Republic as their backyard?
Take this other question you got.
I actually wanted to ask a question on a slightly different topic because you mentioned Kosovo.
You could also just identify yourself.
Tom Bridle from the National Democratic Institute. I wanted to ask about Kosovo and the Balkans because you mentioned Kosovo. And in particular, I wanted to ask about what the Czech position is on Kosovo, what you think about the Russian role in Kosovo, and what's going to happen in Bosnia with the new special representative there.
Okay. We'll have to extend the program another half an hour, but go ahead.
Well, whether Russia see us as still as a backyard, to a certain extent, yes, but, you know, we still have the advantage because we are the most Western-located country out of those former members of the Russian camp. So, you know, the Czech position is not as delicate as, let's say, the Baltic or the Ukrainian or Moldovan or Georgian. So we have here certain advantage, and there is not a direct border with neither Russia nor the post-Soviet territory. And, you know, you can find many Russians as the real professional with whom you can do the business. You know, Carlsbad, Karlovy Vary, it's now the same like your Brighton Beach or Coney Island. And we can live with that. You know, if they are bringing the money and, you know, investing into the tourist sector, why not? You know, if you talk with the current leaders of Gazprom, most of them are Harvard-educated guys. And, you know, I would like to have my deputies in the government of the same qualities like they do have, with their language skills, with their professionality style. But still, we have to be careful. That's our experience. But it does not mean that we are anti-Russian, not at all. Kosovo and Bosnia. I think on Kosovo, we do not have, in this upcoming debate, we would not be in the extreme position either there or there. There are the countries who have the tendency to side with the Serbs. For Slovakia, it's somehow sensitive. It's even a political debate in the parliament. It's not our case. On the other hand, we don't have the tendency to push this. You know, the independence must be recognized tomorrow. So would be searching for some common position, and if the time show us that the common position is not possible, then we will act accordingly. I guess what is important to act in a way that Kosovo would not end up under the influence of the Organization of the Islamic State, so if declares the independence, somebody in the West must recognize it. At the same time, we should not act that Serbia would fall under the Russian influence, so we should continue to talk to the rational politicians there, like President Tadic, Foreign Minister Jeremic, and others. Those are the intelligent guys, and I think that they constitute the future of the country. You know, with our Czech and Slovak experience, you can offer them light advices. You know, the Czechs were ready to accept the Slovak aspirations in 92. So, you know, I told them, to Tadic or to Jeremic, so try to start the change, to change the mood. Try to explain the Serbian people that, you know, it does, if they want to be independent, so why to fight for this? It's some distant territory in the mountains, you know, in the modern global economy, it does not have any sense, you know, to keep a colony somewhere. You can make your money easily, much more easily. The problem is that the emotions are still so high, so their argument is that they would like to argue this way, but if they do that, probably they would find a bullet in their head quite soon, like Džinđić. So we need some time, but, you know, I can't imagine that Kosovar would be ready to wait for years. So they had some promise, and they would. So I think in January you will see some development. On Bosnia, My understanding is that there are some problems because they do not fulfill their obligations regarding the police reform. The Slovak envoy, Mr. Lajčák, is today in Washington, and he's quite frustrated. He lacks the support of the EU. You know, the people are tired or focused on Kosovo, so probably they did not understand the depths of the problem in Bosnia. I think that the previous man who was responsible in on behalf of the international communities, Mr. Schwarzschild, didn't do a spectacular job. He was too weak. But look, should handle that. There is no other way, and I don't think that this is, you know, we are in a danger of having some restoration of the conflict there, but to have some stable solution, it's still very distant. Okay.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Thank you very much, Ambassador Vondra. And if you could just remain seated for a moment, well, I recognize the representatives of the Friends of Slovakia would like to make a presentation. And I also should recognize Ambassador Petar Kolar from the Czech Republic to Ambassador to Washington here. And it's a pleasure to have you with us. I will turn the stage now over to the delegation from the Friends of Slovakia. Here, let me...
And he has also contributed greatly to the strong relationship between the United States and the Czech Republic. And on behalf of the Board of Directors of the Friends of Slovakia, it is my pleasure to present to him today the Friends of Slovakia Medal of Honor.
If I could just add a word. We first met, I think, after you got out of jail before the Velvet Revolution, and you were as outspoken and feisty then as you are now. And then, as now, you were a great supporter of freedom before and after the Velvet Revolution, and it is really wonderful to see the degree to which you and your country have contributed to keeping together the transatlantic partnership. So just as a personal note, and as founding chairman of Friends of Slovakia, I just wanted to say congratulations.
I know the Deputy Prime Minister and my former boss is heading to the airport, so I'll be brief. I would like to present the Deputy Prime Minister with a certificate of appreciation on behalf of American Friends of the Czech Republic and Friends of Slovakia. So I wouldn't read it. May I just present it to you? And we also have a gift for you. Mm-hmm. But we recognize that you're flying and you can't take this framed picture. It would be very inconvenient on the plane.
Yeah.
But it's a memento that I think you would appreciate since you had so much to do with this statue becoming reality in Washington. So please accept it with our best wishes.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. What is that?
That.
Oh, yeah. It's in the other form.
Yes.
Well, so thank you very much. Thank you for all those gifts. Thanks for the words of appreciation. Thanks to you coming here, and I hope that the tradition of the Czech and Slovak Freedom Lecture in Washington would survive. So wish you good luck here, and it was nice to stay with you, and I definitely will come again. So thank you so much.